From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
Charles Manson has died at the age of 83.
CBS News has suspended our co-host Charlie Rose over allegations of sexual misconduct.
Haitians who took refuge in the United States after a devastating earthquake in 2010 now have to be out of the U.S. by July of 2019.
Somebody told me about the tweet a couple of days ago. I don't even tweet. I'm just saying, why is that on your mind? All this stuff going on, and that's on your mind that a father didn't say thank you?
The FCC has voted to start dismantling this net neutrality rule. The rule currently forbids broadband providers from interfering with web traffic.
Mr. President, is an accused child molester better than a Democrat? Is an accused
child
molester
better than a Democrat? Well, he denies it. I mean, if you look at what is really going on, and you look at all the things that have happened over the last 48 hours, he totally denies it. He says it didn't happen. And, you know, you have to listen to him also.
You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/thewheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. On this day before Thanksgiving, we're talking about some of the big news of the week with Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy there, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Dan Harris here. He's columnist and associate editor at Hearst Connecticut Media. Hi there, Danny.
Good morning.
And Susan Bigelow, contributor at ctnewsjunkie.com. Hello, Susan.
Good morning.
Well, let's start for at least a brief period of time about, I guess, the story of the week, the month, a series of sexual harassment allegations coming out against powerful men. The one that Donald Trump was just talking about there, Roy Moore, Donald Trump now openly supporting him in his bid for the Senate in Alabama. We can talk about that a little bit. But, Colin, it's also followed by a series of other things happening within our industry. Charlie Rose has now been fired from CBS after allegations of what he did during his PBS days. Al Franken facing potentially now a second accuser, the senator from Minnesota. Glenn Thrush, a very well-known writer who a lot of us read from the New York Times and formerly Politico. I don't know what to make of all these things, Colin. One thing I will say is these are all very different fact patterns, it seems. And unlike the Roy Moore story, you do have this series of high-profile people in the media or the Senate not saying, I didn't do it, but saying some different version of I did it, but. I don't know what you make of all these things coming out all at once.
Well, the most important thing is something you've just said, which is all of them are different. And so, there are certain yardsticks that we can apply in general, and we can talk about the moment that we're in, because it's not so much the public figures who've changed, it is we who have changed. And so our new thinking about this is some of the things that might disqualify an argument in the past no longer automatically disqualify an argument. So it's too old, it goes back to 1977, that's no longer a disqualifier. The accusing woman might have some other motivation to do this. Again, that's no longer an automatic disqualifier. We will still listen to that argument. You may ultimately make up your mind that Leanne Tweeden has too many motivations to smear Al Franken, or you may make up your mind the opposite way. But to me, that's the thing that's changed anyway, is that, back in the late 90s, when Broderick and Jones and Willie came forward, those of us who were kind of more or less inclined to think that the presidency of Bill Clinton was on balance okay, we tended to find reasons not to listen to them. I'm not saying that they all deserve to be listened to or that they were all telling the truth, but we didn't go that far down the road. We just thought it would be just so inconvenient if they were right about that. So we kind of ignored them, and I would put myself in that category. Now I think they would get a longer hearing. We still might ultimately decide that there are things about their stories that would disqualify them. And you can, if you go back a little bit before that, one more thing I went back and reread. I reread a story by Michael Kelly in Vanity Fair, I think, called Ted Kennedy on the Rocks. I think it ran in 1991 or 1990. And there are these descriptions of Ted Kennedy and Chris Dodd going into restaurants in Washington, D.C., and essentially assaulting waitresses. I mean, these are garish and really upsetting descriptions. And the fallout from that was nothing, absolutely nothing. Nobody did anything about it. So I think what's changed is us, not so much the guys who do these things.
But before I move on to others to get their take on this, Colin, though, Have we changed, or have we changed this week? Like, so much of everything that we talk about in the news is something that maybe we'd never thought about, and somebody's tweeting about it now, and maybe we're not going to be thinking or tweeting about it next week. I wonder if this is actually a change in the way we perceive these things, or a temporary change based on something of the moment right now.
Well, I'll be interested to hear what Susan and Danny say about this. I think it will be hard to go all the way back anyway. I mean, you're right that we may have taken three steps forward, one and a half of which we'll take back at some point. But I think that there's sort of a gain, some kind of net gain that you know, has changed and has made us much more watchful about this stuff. And I think one of the symptoms of that is that people are, to a certain degree, willing to look past political tribalism. Not all people, but there are people who are willing to look past political tribalism on both sides of the aisle and say, you know what, this guy's from my party, or this person is, you know, somebody I have political sympathies with, but that doesn't make this okay. We still have to look at this really hard.
Right now, the tendency, and in all of these cases, is to say, yes, we believe these women, and that's good and right and viable, and there is a difference between what generally people in the Republican Party, the right, are saying in reaction, which is these people are liars and the media is making fake news, and the right, which is saying, well, you know. Now, Charlie Rose had a very interesting statement, which was that I thought it was consensual. I was wrong. And so he's really the furthest along in apologizing, even probably further along than Louis C.K. But that doesn't make it right. And so we're back to where we were. It's sort of just an observation, my way of saying I don't think that we are apolitical in this. I do think people are still lining up along political lines, and that's still going to be a problem. As to whether we've changed, it would be interesting to note that Donald Trump was the agent of change here, the object of change, not the agent. He was the agent of no change. He was the object of the change. He's going to get away with what he did, which was arguably worse than what most of these cases are. But that may have been the catalyst.
Susan?
So this isn't something that people just started paying attention to this week. If we're talking about women who have been paying attention to this since forever. What's changed, I think, now is that women's voices have been amplified just because of a lot of different things, all the things that have happened over the last year, the election of Donald Trump, that there seems to have come a point where people are saying, women are saying especially, look, we're not taking this anymore. Now is not a time to be silent. Now is the time to speak. And, you know, once Harvey Weinstein's allegations came out, it kind of snowballed from there. Women have been abused by powerful men since going back to the beginning of time. It's just something that's been happening. I think that the change, if there is a change, is that finally these voices are actually being heard. People are actually listening to women instead of just dismissing, which is what happened. Every single case I can think of, there's always been someone who's tried to dismiss it as nothing. You know, if you talk about like the Kobe Bryant allegations, we go back to Anita Hill. All of these things, there's always going to be someone saying, no, well, that it's just what she said versus he said. And there's political motivation behind this, and there's some other excuse. Or the woman has something in her past that makes her untrustworthy. There's always going to be excuses. And what I'm seeing now is that suddenly there's just no tolerance for this. I think that's a really good thing.
Definitely a very good thing. A lot of what we focus on right now, Susan, though, is the repercussions of all this. Because in each of these cases of high-profile men, mostly high-profile white men, but as you've suggested, not all, we talk about Al Franken. What's going to happen with him? Will he be forced to resign his Senate seat over this? And you look at the allegations against him, the allegations against other people. I mean, where do you think we go with the talk of, say, Al Franken and whether or not he belongs in the United States Senate as we're considering whether or not Roy Moore deserves the chance to get into the United States Senate after what he has done?
I worry that there's going to be a tendency for us to say, well, you know, there's gradations of these things. And
there are gradations.
There are gradations, yes. But are we really saying, well, okay, some of these things are worse than the other. Which ones are we going to say are worse than the others? I think there's going to be a tendency, and I've seen this on the left already, to kind of say, oh, well, this woman that's accusing Al Franken had a political reason to do so. But honestly, I don't know. I mean, for a woman to come forward and make any kind of accusation against a powerful man is always really, really, really dangerous because you open yourself up to being smeared mercilessly, mercilessly. Look what's happening to the women who came forward in Alabama. They're getting it, and it's awful. So anytime anybody comes forward, they know that they're in for just this awful storm of repercussions. So, you know, people are actually believing these allegations for the first time. I think we're really actually open to believing them. But as for what should happen to Al Franken, I think he should resign. I really do. And I think that that he should resign because there has to be zero tolerance for this kind of behavior going forward.
Colin?
I think Franken's problem, to me anyway, is that in each of these instances, and there are two now, in each of these instances, the way that he's ultimately responded after a pretty wooden and leaden, I guess you can't be both, response the first time, is kind of, I don't remember it that way. You know, my memory of this is very different, or I don't remember that incident at the state fair or whatever, which is very different from saying, no way that ever happened, I don't do that. And I'm not, I mean, once again, what we're doing now is really sort of interpreting as opposed to knowing. But when I hear somebody say that, I feel as though they're being coached a little bit by crisis management people who are telling them, don't say something that could absolutely categorically be disproven. So don't say, no way, I never do that, just in case there's proof that you do that, because that makes it worse. So in a way, that's a little bit of Franken's problem. The other problem that Franken has is, what is he best known for these days? I would say that he's best known for these very effective, mostly moral grillings of villainous Trump nominees awaiting confirmation and things like that. You know, he's very good at asking these very pointed questions. He doesn't mind making somebody uncomfortable in a Senate hearing. I'm wondering whether he's going to be as good at the – he just may not have the heft and traction under the current circumstances, whether he's guilty or innocent or whatever. I mean, he's damaged in a way that may make him considerably less effective at the thing that he's probably best known for doing, which might be another argument for resigning.
Yes, super hard to get up on the high horse.
There certainly are gradations of sexual harassment behavior and worse. And if – one of the problems is, A, we're not prepared to codify those gradations, and B, we don't know what happened. You know, this is a tip of an iceberg type of thing for any given person. It's a pattern of behavior, and that's a sense of belief. But we can believe accusers or not believe them. But if an accuser is credible, regardless of of all the other circumstances, it's believe. Okay, let's believe it. But what we don't know is the assumption in everybody's mind of what else happened, you know. And so it gets built up and built up and built up. And a lot of this stuff is people legitimately don't remember because a lot of it is alcohol fueled. I've talked with a lot of women about this lately. I do agree that with a lot of people who say it's basically 100% of women who have had something happen. And a lot of it is alcohol fueled, and it's something that shouldn't be ignored.
It shouldn't be ignored, but I assume it shouldn't be glossed over either. I mean, if exactly what happened or what we believe happened with Al Franken happened, Dan, are you saying that's
censure? The two accusations that have come forward and given his response, that would warrant a Senate censure.
I think if you compare it to history, I mean, Jerry Studs and stuff like that. That makes sense, but we're not in that moment right now. So, you know.
Well, there's Senate censure, and then there's also, you know, what can he do politically? What do the people of Minnesota think, et cetera? What do you think, Susan?
Well, again, I do think he should step down because, you know, he has tried to make a name for himself as a moral voice. And this is why this is bouncing back on him so hard, because he set himself up as a moral voice. And this is kind of why it didn't bounce back on Donald Trump, because it's like what Krusty the Clown said in The Simpsons, that for the pie gag to work, the sap's got to have dignity. And, you know, we all knew what Donald Trump was. He has no shame and no remorse and no moral standing. But Al Franken has at least pretended, or at least tried, to have that kind of moral standing. I don't think he can be effective at what he does anymore. And if he does resign, I think that sends an important message that, no, this behavior can't be tolerated. Even though we say there's gradations, I worry that we're going to say, all right, if we do the gradations thing, then we excuse this behavior and this behavior, and then where does it go from there?
A real quick phone call here from Peter in Stanford. Hi, Peter.
Well, yes. Al Franken had an occupational hazard because, you know, he was a comedian, so he had blue comedy. Is Louis C.K. now disqualified from the Senate or public office because he was a comedian and he was doing all these raunchy things? But I also want to ask, I Googled Kay Ivey. Does she have any children? And I couldn't find that she had kids. Having children, or particularly daughters in particular, I don't have any kids myself, but having daughters, would that change your perspective? Well, we know that Trump does, and we've seen the horrific things he said about his daughter on the Howard Stern show and so on. But having kids, is that sort of a a barometer of how you feel about these things?
I don't think so. First of all, it is one of the things I've been thinking about Franken is that, you know, we all remember one or two occasions where Trump has grabbed his daughter pretty much the way Franken is said to have grabbed the woman at the state fair. I did want to say one thing about Peter's initial thing, which is that Franken's book, which is his most recent book, Giant of the Senate, which I've read, is very much almost obsessively about the difficulty of making a transition from a career in comedy to a career in the Senate, and the fact that while you were in comedy, you would write and say things that were very transgressive. And even in his first primary in Minnesota, his opponents jumped on like an essay he'd written for Playboy about sex in the future. And it was totally a comic essay, but if you pull certain paragraphs out, it just, you know, it's very difficult. And they had to put out all these complicated statements about it. So he is making, has made a very unusual transition from the very transgressive comedy. And remember, he goes back to the so-called Belushi days. You know, he's got a past that's very different from your typical U.S. senator. And, of course, I think for Kid Rock, he has to look at this and say, well, it's maybe another reason.
Your quick thought, Dan?
To the caller's question, as the father of one child who's a daughter, age 22, I agree with the caller. That does change my outlook on a lot of things, including this.
I want to quickly turn to what's happening in the House of Representatives, trying to jam through a tax bill very, very fast. Just yesterday on Where We Live, Congressman Joe Courtney was here talking about this House tax bill.
It's moving at Mach speed, which, again, by itself is really the warning flag should be up, because the law of unintended consequences happens when you rush things. And we're talking about the biggest rewrite of the tax code since 1986. If you go back to 1986 when Ronald Reagan was president and Tip O'Neill and Dan, you know, it was a well over a year process, very open and transparent, normal order. And frankly, that's been totally brushed aside.
So Joe Courtney raising the issue, Colin, that this tax bill the Republicans are trying to get through is going way too fast, trying to learn what's in it. It seems as though taxes are going to go up on an awful lot of people in America. They're going to go down for corporations.
Even if you want to know about this, it's made more complicated by the fact that there are effectively two bills. There's a House bill and a Senate bill. They have many similarities, but they also have very significant differences. And I'll just jump ahead and say, one of the shoals on which this thing may run aground is just the difficulty of reconciling these two versions, because they are different enough, so it's not going to be easy. But Danny's shaking his head. But let's go back to the House bill, and let's go back to what their basic goal is, because there's as Joe Courtney is saying, there's a lot in there. But if you were to identify why is this happening at all? The answer seems to be that they want to cut the corporate tax rate, and it's a drastic cut from 35 to 20. And then the question is, how do you pay for that if you're not going to build up the deficit? How are you going to pay for such a big tax cut? And then the answers start coming. Well, it's going to be people who live in mostly blue states where state and local taxes are rather high and previously have been deductible. It's going to be paid for by people with massive medical expenses who could previously deduct those medical expenses. It's going to be paid for
college debt
and also graduate students whose two free tuition is not currently treated as income, teachers who, you know, write off $250 in school supplies. I mean, it's sort of a long list of people. And, you know, and the other thing I'll just say really quickly, because I know everybody has stuff to say about this, is the other thing that strikes me as intellectually dishonest about this is this, if there's one other overarching thing you could say about this effort, it really is loophole friendly to the rich and sort of the opposite to people of normal means. So in other words, one of the things they're doing is they're doubling the standard deduction so that, you know, 85% of the people who currently are middle-class people who itemize would probably no longer itemize, because the standard deduction would be big enough so that the incentive would grow smaller. On the other end, they've got getting rid of the alternative minimum tax, which is the one way, typically, you can get the Donald Trumps of this world to pay something, no matter how good their tax attorneys are and everything like that. You can make, the whole idea of the AMT is, yeah, but you've got to pay something. So you've got that, and you've got things like pass-throughs, which you've talked about before. So to the rich, it's an invitation. Go crazy. Try to get out of your taxes. Find every freaking loophole that you want, and we're actually increasing the size of some of those loopholes and your opportunity to use them. For the middle class, don't even go to HR Block. Just, you know, sign the thing and send it.
This is like a funhouse mirror of a kind of typical, what we would have thought of as a typical Republican tax policy. It's so garish. It's so hypocritical. And it's so brazenly done. It's breathtaking, frankly. And the fact that it's moving so fast and it's so badly put together, I feel like they just sort of woke up, realized, like that student who wakes up at noon and realizes their essay is due at 1, and, you know, they've rushed to get this thing together, and it's just terrible. It's just a mess. They didn't think about this at all in all the years that they were out, where they controlled the House and the Senate, but not the presidency. They didn't think about any of this stuff. It's just like healthcare. They didn't plan it out. They have no idea what they're really doing. They just want to win. That's all that they want, is to pass something. And it's a disaster.
Danny?
The primary attack in the bill, let's just talk for the moment about the House version, because generally speaking, it's more severe, and because the Senate version is still evolving. The primary attack is not so much on the middle class as we know to be the middle class in the $50,000 to $70,000 household range, or $80,000 or $90,000 in Connecticut. It's more on the $90,000 to $200,000 household range, especially those that live in cities and don't have a lot of kids, but who do have high mortgages and a lot of deductions, and live in states that have an income tax. And so what you look at is, you look at that demographic, say, where do they live? Okay, typically they live in urban areas. Right. So one thing we see is that this is essentially a war on cities. It's a war on education. It's a war on cities. It's a war on humanities. It's a war on preservation of historic properties. And so when you put all that together, you see a right-wing reaction, a culture war, a reaction against that which is the thing they perceive to be the problem. Right. The other totally different aspect of this, which ties together, is it's a war on complexity. Because the Republicans, especially the formerly known as Tea Party Republicans, now known as Republicans, are attacking what they perceive to be too many loopholes, too complex, and they're conflating simple and fair. They're saying simple and fair in the same sentence. Well, no, that's actually not the way it works. Fair is lots of gradations of things. Simple is simple. And so they want to make it simple because they perceive.
Can I ask you a question? Yeah. As a sort of macroeconomics person, which I am not, is there an argument? Do American corporations need their rate cut from 35 to 20? Except for GE, I don't see anybody in a death spiral right now.
I looked up a few days ago, I looked up some of the cash on hand of some of the companies. Generally, the global companies and the Fortune 100 are holding cash. And obviously, it's a big, broad range. But UTC, for example, is in, I believe, $6 to $8 billion range. Pfizer is more than that. Apple, famously, is down from $100 billion in cash to $75 billion or so in cash. And so, what the point about that, and I think the point you're making, is that if you give companies that are already sitting on cash because there's no demand for their services, there's no demand for vast expansion, more cash, they're not going to expand. I agree with that.
So and we should also say the bill balances on the notion of a 3% growth rate, at least one of the versions.
We're only going to get through an expansion of immigration, which is the opposite of what the administration is doing.
They actually asked CEOs what they were going to do if this bill passed, and they got all this tax money back. And very few of them said that they were going to expand and create jobs and all that kind of stuff. They're going to pay down debt. And they're going to pay their shareholders. They're going to make dividends for their shareholders. And that's it. It's the rich giving money back to the rich instead of this idea it'll trickle down to everybody else. So even the basic theory behind the tax cuts is wrong.
Danny, in just 20 seconds, you wrote about something else, an unintended consequence that could be bad for us. here, historic renovations of properties going away?
Yeah, the historic preservation tax credit does go away. Again, the theory is that there's lots more cash in the economy and it takes care of that. The problem is for any given property, the benefit is accrued by all of us in the community, not the developer and the owner of that property. And you can't get that money into the developer's hands unless you give them money from the public.
And that's money that's done an awful lot of good in places like Connecticut and all over New England.
Nothing short of reviving the entire urban economy.
Dan Haar is here. He's a columnist for Hearst Connecticut Media. Susan Bigelow is a contributor at ctnewsjunkie.com. Colin McEnroe hosts The Colin McEnroe Show. When we come back, more on the week's news here in The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join us at 860-275-7266 if you want to talk about the week's news. And we're talking today with Dan Haar from Hearst Connecticut Media, Susan Bigelow from ctnewsjunkie.com, and our own Colin McEnroe. Hey, Colin, what's on your show today?
Well, one thing that I think a lot about is why does nobody trust the official version of anything anymore? And a lot of it, I think, goes back to a horrible event whose anniversary we observe today, the assassination of JFK. So we're going to kind of look at that and its lasting effects on how we understand even the nature of authority, who you can invest your trust and confidence in America.
That's coming up today on the Colin McEnroe Show. Governor Dan Malloy, well, he wasn't exactly in the room for all the negotiations between Republicans and Democrats to get a new biennial state budget, a budget which is now already out of balance, which we'll talk about in a moment. But he gets a chance to dish out some of the cuts that are in there. Reading from the Connecticut Mirror, Connecticut got a clearer picture of the painful cuts imposed in the new budget. More than $880 million in spending cuts mandated by the General Assembly. Labor cost-cutting moves as required under last summer's concessions deal with unionized state employees account for the biggest chunk of those savings. So he's handing out a whole bunch of cuts, which are going to be painful to towns and cities and a lot of other folks. And the lawmakers who wrote the budget are now complaining about the way he made the cuts, Colin?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe there's another way to understand this. I don't study the budget the way some journalists do, but I don't get this. I mean, it seems to the way that I understand it, they mandated the cuts. They weren't super specific about how to make them. There aren't, according to the people who really do understand the budget, very many other ways to make them besides the ones that he's doing, which are undeniably painful in the social services sector and for cities and towns. These are very, very tough cuts. But the people who did that were our inept legislators who, you know, were 4 months late getting this done at all, didn't really do it with very specific language. And I don't know. I mean, I just feel like Mo, Larry, and Curly took responsibility for the messes that they made for the most part. But for the, you know, Marty and Joe and Lynn and Themis don't.
Yeah. So here's actually some quotes from Senate President Martin Looney. It is a source of grave concern that the administration chose to carry out the cuts in this manner. End quote. And now here's Themis Claridis. The governor's brazen decision to ignore the intent of the compromise budget is bare. I like the intent of the compromise budget is bare sabotage and the clearest indication yet that he'll spend his remaining time in office working to punish anyone who has opposed his failed policies. I'm not looking at the budget as closely as some of our colleagues are, Dan, but I have to say I'm not exactly sure what else the governor is supposed to do here. What is it they're yelling about?
Well, this is a bit of the turkeys coming home to roost from Weathersfield. how many metaphors can I mix here?
You're in fan of country already.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, okay. I'll continue to channel Keith. Part of what's happening is here is that these things, strictly speaking or technically speaking, these are called lapses. When something is there's a holdback and there's a lapse. A holdback is when you don't give money to something like a town. And so there were $90 million in holdbacks and $90 million in lapses here. And so the lapses are things that the outrage coming from the four caucus leaders, especially Themis Claridis and Len Fasano, is that these are things that actually count, that matter. We thought you were going to use toothpicks and bubblegum to do this, like we always have in the past. Not actual real painful cuts. And the governor called them on it. And that's essentially largely what's happening here, is that these are real cuts to real agencies, to real programs. There were $55 million in what's called program cuts, as in that's gone. And the reason that that's happening is because we're all out of the toothpick and bubblegum stuff, and the governor has said this is what we have to do. But it's always in the past been, well, you know, we're cutting, we're not hiring, and we're sort of out of that stuff. Part of it is that, and part of it is still anger over the labor concessions.
Yeah. The governor's cuts, I mean, the legislature actually, they're so lazy in this case, I feel like. They just put in the budget, oh, the governor will make, the executive branch will make cuts somehow. And when the governor actually does make the cuts, they're outraged about it. But the Damolo is a useful punching bag for them. And that's
lazy, too.
Of course it is.
Having the porcupine, who nobody likes, to kick around when you don't want to own what you did, that's lazy.
Of course it is. And they, you know, they'll attack him and blame it all on him when really they've been spending how many months trying to put this together, and they put it together in a really sloppy way. Of course it's their fault, but they don't ever want to take responsibility for that because, again, yeah, these cuts are actually pretty painful.
Well, they would have taken, responsibility for it if they would have made some very specific prescriptions in here. They would have taken some sort of hit. They all have to worry about running for re-election. Dan Malloy does not. Here's something Dan Malloy is going to try to do. Colin, he wants to bring them back into special session because we talked about this a little bit last week, but we're already in a $200-some million deficit in the brand new budget.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, Danny may be more up to date, or Danny and Susan probably are more up to date on this than I am, but there's still, I believe, the sword of Damocles, which is the CHA thing that is unresolved. They don't really know yet where the federal government's going to approve that. So not only are they out of balance, but there's like one big unanswered question here. I mean, right, that still is an unanswered question, isn't it?
Go ahead, Susan, real quick.
Yeah. Of course, the budget is out of balance again because once again a couple of things happened. Medicaid didn't come. The Medicaid reimbursement didn't come through as much as they wanted it to. And of course, the revenues are down again. They are once again very bad at predicting how much revenue is actually going to come in. I feel like at this point, whenever they make a revenue estimate, just cut it by 25%, and maybe then it'll be right.
Yeah, this is one of the results of having a budget that starts 4 months late, is that when trends in the – it looks like, oh, my God, we only have the budget for 17 days, and it's already $178 million out of whack. The reality is we've had a budget for 4 months and 17 days, now 22 days, and it's $178. The deficit doesn't care when the budget gets signed. It's a budget. It's you're spending money during the year starting July 1st. But I would make the point that just to Colin's point about CHA, that's the Connecticut Hospital Association, large, very complex tax trick in which Connecticut taxes the hospitals by 8% of their revenues, not profits, revenues, a huge amount, and then gives it all back to them under a formula and goes to Medicaid and said, see, we're giving aid to hospitals. Match that, please. And we're asking the federal government to ask to increase their allowable exemption reimbursement by 2 percentage points from 6% to 8%, and we're doing it 3 months late.
That's what I meant when he said that thing.
that thing. Let's go to a quick phone call. Ken's in Hartford. Hey, Ken.
Hey, gentlemen and ladies, good morning. Or I shouldn't say good morning, but I listen to this budget deal all the time. And in 2011, when Dan Malloy took office, there were 10 people in the state of Connecticut worth $33 billion. Today, those same 10 people in the state of Connecticut are worth more than $60 billion. So I'm having real trouble sitting here saying, well, we need to cut aid and we need to deal with percentage points on hospitals and taxes and all of these things when there's 10 people in the state of Connecticut who have, in 7 years, sucked up enough wealth to run the state of Connecticut for a year. And I'm trying to figure out how I wrap my head around the civic sphere being constricted while this private wealth is growing at an almost geometric rate.
I want to put that first to Dan Haar.
Let me ask you, Ken, and I want you to use a famous quote that you've already used once before. If we ask those people for more money, how much are they going to give? Not
a dime back.
Not a dime back. Thank you. That's the problem, is that Connecticut happens to have porous borders, and we can name 4 billionaires who have already left to move to Florida and made it clear that that's why they were leaving.
So let me just play this out for a second, though. As Susan just said, our consensus tax revenues for the last, as long as I've been covering the budget, honestly, it's almost never right. We never get the money that we expect from taxpayers in the state to actually be able to balance the budget, to be able to grow economically. It's not happened forever. What Ken and many other people say, Dan, is, look, yes, there are porous borders. Yes, these billionaires can leave, but they are sitting on an awful lot of money. Other states, including Massachusetts, are looking very closely at, are we going to impose some sort of new higher millionaires tax? That's where the money is. We don't seem to be able to get the revenues in any other way.
In 1991, the Connecticut passed the controversial income tax, yes. And in so doing, it retired the, was it 13%, up to 13%, I believe, dividend tax and capital gains tax. That was the boon to the super wealthy, and it hasn't recovered since.
Mm.
We can use the rich as an ATM. We can. And we can go to them, and we can try to tax them. Of course, they'll just rent a post office box in the Cayman Islands and they'll move all their wealth wherever they want to move it because they can. But the problem that I have, and I used to be a very big believer in, we really need to get the rich, we really need to get the money out of them. I used to be a big believer in this, but I believe it less now because it gives the rich way too much power. And if they decide to move that money, even though they've been highly taxed somewhere else, then it leaves us in the lurch. Then we have really no recourse. We had to go back and do something else.
Yeah, and the counter-argument, of course, to what we were just talking about, Colin, is because income tax can be so very, very volatile, the fact that we haven't been able to make these revenue assessments very well in the past, the more we rely on income tax, especially of the rich, the more we potentially fall prey to not being able to make up those revenues in the future.
Yeah, and I mean, just to just amplify what both Susan and Dan have said, I mean, it's sort of 6 months plus one day. I mean, it's a pretty easy thing for rich people to not live in Connecticut, even if they have a pretty substantial presence here. I don't know. I mean, once again, I'm the worst economist at the table here. So, I mean, one thing I keep thinking is the stock market's doing pretty well, and I know that we don't get that money until they actually take their profits and stuff like that, but you would think that at some point, you know, the revenue estimates would be on the short side of reality. Maybe that'll never come.
That does actually happen in good times, but yeah. Connecticut isn't creating jobs. And what tends to happen is when the economy is expanding, that's when the income tax revenue projections tend to be too low. We'd like to see that, but it isn't happening.
It does happen occasionally.
It happens in boom times.
Yeah. Given that we're not necessarily in a boom time right now, there's been a lot of question about who wants the job of being the next governor of the state of Connecticut. We now know that Nancy Wyman, the current lieutenant governor, very popular certainly amongst the labor crowd, but very popular across the board. People love Nancy Wyman, and probably many Democrats were steering clear of getting into the race, thinking she might run. Well, now, Colin, she says she's not going to. So let's talk for a moment or two about the dominoes falling out of that.
Well, they're sort of pale and uninteresting dominoes for the most part. But you know, I was the most amused by the fact that in football, there's this thing where a team will quickly try to hike the ball if they think the other team might challenge the call. Because if you get the ball snapped fast enough, then you can't challenge the previous call. I just noticed this wave of thank you, Nancy Wyman, for your service from Chris Maddie, thank tweeted her. I think he got the first one out. And then this was followed by Jonathan Harris and Joe Gannon. They were just in such a rush to thank Nancy Wyman for her service, so she couldn't change her mind, apparently. But it doesn't leave them with – I mean, it leaves them with a problem we knew they were going to have, which is a kind of, you know, brand X, not typically interesting field. referred to, I think, in the current by as the lesser known candidates, which should be the name of the indie band that they form or something. The lesser known candidates.
God, what a terrible band.
Go ahead, Susan.
Yeah, no, the problem the Democrats have is that they really don't have any viable candidates. I don't see a governor in the bunch. And it's not surprising that the Democrats feel like they're probably gonna lose the seat next year. And it's not, you know, if you look back at the history of how these things happen, there's good precedent for that. Whenever Connecticut has an open seat in the governor's mansion, party changes. So there's a very good chance, especially because Dan Malloy is extremely unpopular, that the Democrats are going to lose this seat, so nobody wants to risk it.
If the bench is short for the Democrats, what about the Republicans, Susan? I mean, part of what you need to actually take back that seat is a compelling character on the Republican side.
Oh, there's none of those. I don't see anybody there who's really all that interesting either. So, I don't know. Yes?
Dan Har?
Well, Themis Claridis, the minority leader of the House, is that compelling candidate, both in terms of her presence and ability to campaign and in terms of the argument that she's going to bring. There are holes in that argument, and we've been talking about some of those holes. One way to keep her out of the race is to keep this budget debate alive. As long as the budget debate is she said that she's going to say what she'll do when the budget debate is over, and she thought that would be September, then October, then November. Now it looks like we're going to go into December. And so it could go so far that she never gets into the race because she's working on the budget.
I'd be surprised if she runs. I'd be shocked because she has a good chance of being speaker next year, and that's a lot more fun than being governor.
Well, does she, though? You know,
I think she does.
You look at the way things went two Tuesdays ago in the state. Republicans had a really bad day at the municipal level, which we know is a dangerous extrapolation to make. But if I looked at everything that happened in the state of Connecticut last Tuesday and I were Themis Claridis, I'd be thinking, maybe I'm not going to be speaker. Maybe we're not going to pick up a whole bunch of seats.
Last time I looked, there are not statues of in granite of speakers around the roof of the state capitol.
That's because they would be toppled by the mobs immediately.
She's going to have to reckon with her Trump support. That's for sure. That's one thing.
Okay, well, let's just quickly go to one potential Democratic candidate who is at least a little bit interesting, Colin. You know, Luke Bronin has struck many people as the sort of person who's measured the drapes in various offices in order to try to make a rise through the political ranks. He's now the mayor of Hartford. That's not necessarily where a lot of the politicians of American history start things off, but he is there now. He's, of course, a close confidant of the governor. He worked in the governor's office. Is Luke Bronin an actual candidate here?
Well, he's trial ballooning this right now, and I don't know. I'm so upset by this. I'm actually kind of personally fond of Luke Bronin. I really like him as a person. I like him and his wife. I think they're great people. And I thought that they were working really hard for Hartford and doing a lot of the things that you need a grown-up to come in and do. And so this so upsets the apple cart of my understanding of who they were. I mean, they've always had that carpetbagger label stuck to them by a lot of people who saw them as craven opportunists who just came in here to this weak political structure, took it over for the as a resume builder, and then they were going to get out and do other stuff. And there was no question that he's a young man in a hurry. But first of all, you have to be able to illustrate some gains. And at the moment, I don't know. What did you just call him? At least a little bit something? That should be a slogan. But, I mean, you know, your city is now being run in large part by a state oversight board, or will be as soon as they get the board put together.
Wait, wouldn't it be fair to say that given the current set of circumstances that a better path forward for the city of Hartford is actually that state oversight that he's seeking right now? I mean, being the governor of Connecticut might be better for the city of Hartford than being the mayor of Hartford.
Right, but you can't run on that. You can't run. First of all, the state oversight board ranks cities and towns that it takes over on a three-tier system, with four basically being your Troy, you know, you're just ruins. So that's not really true. But, I mean, four is the worst. Hartford's a three right now, which is not good. And the other thing is that he said he was going to stay. I mean, he got elected 2 years ago. 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And he said he was going to stay for at least a full term, and he's not. And to me, and can I just say one more thing?
Please do.
It's true of Bisowitz, too. They always say, people just calling me up and just begging me to run. Those people are a mirage. They are not representative of any kind of genuine groundswell that gets into like three digits, right? I mean, it's just such crap to say people are begging.
It's the Muhammad Ali syndrome. You can do it, champ. You can do just this one more fight. You can do it, champ. Luke Bronin, in one sense, is a compelling, to use that word again, candidate, because he's essentially, and I know I get castigated on the left, on the right over here, he's essentially apolitical. He's the ultimate technocrat in Connecticut.
I don't disagree with that.
You don't disagree? No. Okay, good. So, and that's, in some sense, that's probably that's the direction Connecticut is going. Governor Malloy, Dan Malloy, is also something of a technocrat, not as much as Bronin. Bronin is a sort of a hard pragmatist. He came into office and he said, you know, we're going to cut this and we're going to cut that. We're going to cut the unions. And by the way, the unions, Tier 4 allows the state oversight board to set union contracts, essentially. And so that's a big jump from 3 to 4. Mm-hmm. But I think that's an argument that's hard to make politically, but it's an easier argument to make as a logic into your candidacy.
One thing I will say is of the people he probably isn't appealed to very much, Susan, as a short-term mayor of the city of Hartford is, is a lot of those suburban voters who really, really would need to support a Democratic governor. You know, he's talking about making sure that they help to pay for Hartford, which an awful lot of people in greater Hartford in the suburbs think is not really my job. And they thought that for a very long time.
That's right. Yes, he's been out there pushing regional solutions, making the case that the suburbs are responsible for the city and vice versa. And of course, that's absolutely true. But no, nobody in West Hartford wants to hear that. The other thing that people in the suburbs don't like is Dan Malloy. And if there's going to be a candidate in the race who's going to have Dan Malloy hung around his neck more than anybody else, it's going to be Luke Bronin, who came out of Malloy's inner circle.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the things we're thankful for. We talk about a lot of things that we're not thankful for.
Segment.
But it is. We've left only a few minutes for Susan Bigelow, Dan Haar, and Colin McEnroe here in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Talking about the week's news here with Susan Bigelow, Dan Haar, and Colin McEnroe. You wrote an op-ed for CTNewsJunkie.com, Susan. Now, what's there to be thankful for anyway? And I got us thinking about how we should at least spend a moment or two being thankful for some things. What's something you're thankful for right now?
Well, you know, it's been a long year, a long, exhausting, difficult year, especially if you follow politics, which it feels like everybody is tuned into this stuff now, and it is just draining. So it's very easy to get demoralized, and it's very easy to feel very bleak about things and about how things are going. But yeah, I am thankful, and I want to think about this. I want to think about what am I actually thankful for in this kind of political climate. And I'm thankful for a couple of things. I'm thankful for how loud our democracy still is. That yes, there's a lot of shouting, and a lot of that time it can be pretty negative stuff, but we're talking, we're shouting, we're screaming, and I think that loudness is really a buffer against some of the worst things that a man who is bent towards authoritarianism, such as the President of the United States, might want to do. So that actually gives me hope, and I'm thankful for it. So that's absolutely one thing.
Danny?
Net neutrality. Does that work? Net neutrality and the Department of Justice's antitrust division. Can I be thankful for those? No, seriously.
Absolutely.
Okay, but since I don't have time to explain why I'm thankful for that, I would amplify what Susan said and say that I'm thankful for our ability to talk, not just the fact that democracy is loud, but for our individual ability to have these conversations. I do think we're building up a reaction to an unfortunate backward period in politics, both on the state and the national level. This reaction against all things that are civilized is not a positive thing, but we're in a period of entropy in terms of progress, and we're building strength. And so I'm thankful for our individual, for my individual and my family's and our friends' ability to have these conversations in a somewhat cogent way.
Colin?
I want to leave time for you because you have some real interesting stuff to say, but as we gather with friends and family for Thanksgiving, I'm very happy that I am not a member of the Herbst family of Trumbull or the cocaine family of Bristol, who in each case have massive amounts of pending litigation among siblings and parents and things like that. I will be gathering with 20 or so people that I know and love. And unless someone helps me file a lawsuit against Bill Curry in the next 24 hours, there will be no pending litigation among any of us. And I'm very grateful for that.
And thank you for that. I'm, of course, thankful for the people who help us do this program, Kyone Wolf, Katie Talarski, all of the great producers and the talent here at WNPR. I also want to say, though, I'm thankful for people from all over the world who still want to come here. We hear a lot of stories, especially this week, about deportation orders against Connecticut residents who've made lives and raised families and added to the overall economy and the quality of life here after fleeing some pretty terrible circumstances. We're also coming to terms with a decision to eject Haitians who are here under temporary protected status, maybe being forced to go back to one of the poorest countries on earth. We still have people coming here, and they're trying to make their lives here. A reporter I work with in Boston today reported on the family of Somali refugees celebrating their first Thanksgiving in Lowell, Mass. Now, Lowell, Mass, if you don't know it, it's a town like a lot of places in Connecticut. It would have basically folded up shop and closed if not for an influx of people from all over the world who've stepped in and helped to keep old mill towns alive. In New England, we are net exporters of talent. We lose more young people than we gain. And the thing that really keeps us going demographically and growing culturally is the same impulse that we that we talk about celebrating around the dinner table tomorrow. It's people getting out of places where they couldn't worship or raise their kids freely to work their butts off in places like New Haven and Lowell. So thanks to people who still want to come here to America. And thanks for making the place better. Thanks to everyone here. I'm thankful for Susan. Thank you, Susan. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Well, thank you, too.
Thank you to Danny Haar. Very thankful for you. Thank you, sir, for coming in.
Thank you.
And thank you, as always, to Colin McEnroe. Thank you, sir.
Thanks to you, John Dankosky, and to Susan and Dan.
If you want to continue our conversation, go to WNPR.org/thewheelhouse. We'll be here next week.